Please welcome Nick Revel.
Thank you very much. Yes, the title of this talk is How to Be Optimistic Despite All the Evidence. I'll never forget my dad's last words to me. He said, put down that toaster and help me get out of the bath. And I think there's a lesson for us all in that. It's a yin-yang world. You lose a parent, you gain a gag. And personally, I've got to say, I've always found great comfort in treating life as a sick joke, both emotionally as well as professionally. And I think these days it's easy for all of us, perhaps, to be pessimistic at the state of the world. I mean, I've had periods where I'd wake up in the morning, check the news, and ask myself, is it even worth moisturising? But not anymore, because I have a very positive attitude to life now. So let me take you on a journey and show you how to be optimistic despite all the evidence. Step one, a positive perspective. For me, life is just a brief, meaningless interlude between two infinite periods of nothingness. And actually, that's pretty much it, but I think I can unpack it a little bit, starting with this traditional joke. Why did the chicken cross the road? To try and distract herself for a fleeting instant from the constant nagging knowledge that life is just a brief, meaningless interlude between two infinite periods of nothingness, and that death and the awareness of death surely render all human endeavour and institutions ultimately meaningless and without value. Unless, as we spin through space, stuck by the miracle of gravity to a small rock spinning itself around a dying star in an insignificant corner of an obscure galaxy, which is constantly expanding, making us nanosecond by nanosecond even smaller and less significant than we were the nanosecond before. Unless we can embrace all this, gaze defiantly and insouciantly back into the lipless, grinning abyss of absurdity and find the courage to create our own existential authenticity in a godless, meaningless universe. I think it was quite a thoughtful chicken. Well, when I left school, I went to Oxford and I specialised in medieval French, which really impressed my mates back in West Yorkshire. We work underground 8 hours a day, paying tax so that you can sleep with posh birds and study medieval French. What's the point of learning medieval French? I mean, if you ever met a medieval French person, why would you want to talk to them? They're French. But as well as studying Rabelais and Villon and La Chanson de Roland, which is about a battle between Christians and Muslims in the 8th century, reminding us how much the world has moved on, I also got interested in modern France, which was a seditious position for Oxford in those days, and particularly the Paris events of 1968 when the students and the unions almost overthrew the French government. I've always found the French intellectual revolutionary style very attractive, you know, all those black polo necks and Gauloises. You got the feeling that after a hard day at the barricades, they all repaired in the evening to some pavement cafe just off the Boulevard Saint-Michel and spent a long time discussing which wine to order with the food. And I think that's important. There's no point having a revolution if you can't enjoy a little bit of luxury. And my favourite group who were active at that time were the Situationists, basically politically committed prankster artists. And they went around spraying graffiti. And if you see any book with photographs about the events of 68, you will see this piece of graffiti. It says, be realistic, demand the impossible. And I thought, yes, reject the fetters of logic. The human spirit can achieve anything if it is free. Laws, they are just a repressive expression of class interest. Left to flourish in absolute freedom, each individual spirit will move towards the light, will act for the common good in peace and harmony with their fellows, and everything will be, like, okay, because it'll kind of all work out. There were a few more detailed steps in the argument, but you've got to remember I was smoking a lot of hash at the time. And as I got older, I found myself getting more and more sceptical through the stupid error of paying more critical attention to stuff. I mean, one minute I'm thinking a society without laws would lead to utopia. Next, I'm realizing people can't even autonomously dispose of chewing gum in a responsible manner. So maybe administering a global post-industrial society without any formally enforceable social constraints whatsoever might be a bit of a stretch. And I guess I concluded, you have to live in the real world, just like the free market economists tell us. And you have to live in the real world, don't you? I mean, logically, where else is there to live? And I came to learn by carefully studying the newspapers that free market economics is generated from eternal, rock-solid, immutable scientific laws like physics and the Germans always winning a penalty shootout. And admittedly, there are a few sort of glitchy side effects around the edge, you know, like collapsing economies, increasing rage and desperation amongst increasing numbers of dispossessed, global warming, and the prospect that within the next 20 years, everywhere between Cairo and Auckland is going to be either on fire or underwater. But that's just how things are. If there were another way, the market would find it. And this makes me feel really comfortable, you know, because instead of social activism, I find myself spending all my spare time in Italy, eating well and chilling out with a totally clear conscience because the market has explained that change is not possible. I've always loved Italy since I first went to Venice when I was 14, fell in love with the food, the weather, the attitude to life, how they find joy in little details, effortless style, cafe owners who will explain to you exactly how to make a proper espresso, the right blend of Arabica and Robusta, how the humidity of the air determines exactly how finely you grind the beans, or the Italian woman who said to me once, one of the most beautiful things I've ever heard in my life, I very much like Moscato, because it is such a good breakfast wine. Then as you read more and more about Italian history, you find that this ability to find joy in small things is perhaps down to the chaos and unfairness and unpredictability of the big things, the nepotism and the corruption and the insecurity of political life, which has been going on basically since the fall of Rome. But paradoxically, that's how I started to find the grounds for genuine optimism. I'd like to take you now to Tuscany. Radio 4 listeners are gathering from all over the house. 13th century Tuscany, to be precise, Florence and Siena, where effectively the modern Western banking system and capitalism begins. Lots of merchants getting rich in the wool trade. The sheep, who are the fundamental wealth creators, are seeing none of the profits. Do you see a pattern developing? The merchants suddenly have so much gold, they literally don't know what to do with it. And they're worried about it being robbed off them by thieves. So they entrust their gold to goldsmiths who have bullion vaults. And very soon, the goldsmiths stop being goldsmiths and become bankers instead. Yes, people entrusted their money to bankers for fear of it being robbed off them by thieves. That's how banks were invented. And also irony. Then pretty soon we get banknotes. Instead of carrying heavy gold pieces around that might get robbed off you by bandits, they issue notes that says if you take this to the bank, you'll get 10 gold pieces, so it's easier. Next step, they invent fractional reserve banking. You issue more notes than you have gold in the bank, which means that the money can expand through extra money that only exists in people's heads. But that's okay, provided not everybody goes to the bank at the same time to get their gold back. So the reality is partly in the vault and partly in the imagination. And if everyone believes it, it works fine, even if they know it's an abstract idea. The imagination creates the new reality, and it works because everybody agrees to believe in it. Then the bankers start lending out this money at interest. The economy is booming. Loads of people wanting to borrow. They're making millions and millions. Just one problem. Money lending is condemned by the Bible, and you go to hell for it and burn for eternity. This is a tough moral choice for these Christian moneylenders. Immortal soul, we like. This shiny stuff, we like. Burning in hell for eternity, we don't like. There has to be a way around this. First step, they show how pious they are by piously commissioning the building of new churches and pious biblical paintings all over them and pious scenes from the pious lives of pious saints. And then next to the pious saints, they have themselves piously painted in, looking ever so pious and small and humble, obviously. Prime example, the Scrivegni brothers in Padua, who commissioned the painter Giotto to paint frescoes on the wall of their arena chapel, and thus triggering the Renaissance. There's always a complicated relationship between artists and patrons, but that's for another talk. So, on the frescoes on the wall of the arena chapel, you have hell over here, you have heaven over here, and you have a road, and the road is leading to hell. And on the road to hell are the two Scrivegni brothers, looking very pious and kneeling down because angels have descended to say, oh, Scrivegni brothers, you do not have to follow the road to hell because you are ever so pious. Just take a look at yourselves in this pious painting. And then the angels call, Lord, Lord, see how pious the Scrivegni brothers actually are. Well, you're right, and I was just about to strike them down for sinning. But just in case God, the all-seeing, all-knowing, wasn't taken in by the pious painting strategy, the bankers also hire top lawyers and theologians to examine the small print in the Bible to see if maybe there is a loophole. And lo and behold, how surprising, these Italian corporate theological lawyers find a loophole. In the Bible, usury is a sin if you lend out the money and do nothing else but take the interest. But what my client is doing is lending the money for free. He is merely charging legitimate expenses for the administration of the loan. Yes, at 1,000,000% interest a week, but these are office costs. This is not hellfire and damnation evasion. It is simply hellfire and damnation avoidance. So they rewrote the word of God, the God they believed in and feared and believed to be totally omnipotent. They changed his words to defy him and accommodate their business needs. So I say, if you can change that, you can change just about anything if we put our minds to it. Imagination creates the reality. We can bend the real world to our needs, not the other way round, and make it better and fairer. Of course, there's a whole lot of debate to have about how you define better and fairer. That's for another day. But what I would say is this. The real world, as defined by neoliberal economists, is just another construct. They just branded it cleverly to trick us. Anyway, I'm going to finish on another version of the chicken joke. Why someday will the chicken cross the road to be realistic and demand the impossible? And when she does, I shall follow that chicken. Thank you.